So welcome, everybody. Let's begin by doing a very brief or short meditation, and then we'll say some prayers together, and then we'll begin the class. So make yourself comfortable in your seat, meaning have your back straight and shoulders relaxed. And as you breathe normally and naturally, become aware of movements or feelings that are taking place in the abdomen. And just note them as you continue to breathe normally and naturally. And while you're breathing normally and naturally, imagine that all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas appear in your room, in the space in front of you. And on the same level as you, all sentient beings appear. And then recollect that if we wish to be authentic people, authentically practicing the teachings of the Buddha, we have to let go of attachment to just this life, meaning we have to let go of the attachment to the pleasures and happiness of just this life. And to abandon that attachment, it's very useful to rely upon four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma. And these four thoughts are the leisure and opportunity of a fortunate human life, which inspires appreciation for what we have and a recognition of what we're capable of. We need to recollect impermanence and death, so which inspires urgency, and also recollect karmic causality, which inspires agency. The fourth thought that turns the mind to the Dharma is the realization of the unsatisfactory nature of cyclic existence. And this will inspire within us a distaste for compulsive existence and a conviction to strive for the truth, which culminates in a going for refuge. Now, when we go for refuge, it's not just for our own sake. So we take refuge in the three jewels through the abandonment of attachment to the fantasies of just this life, then to all the pleasures of cyclic existence, and to our own singular welfare and to grasping at intrinsic existence. And since only the three jewels and the teacher, indivisible, protect us, we want to encourage ourselves to seek refuge also from the depths of the heart. So we take refuge not just for ourselves, but for everyone else, to lead them out of suffering. So with the idea that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are present and all sentient beings surround us, let's go for refuge together. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And to stabilize and enhance the wish to become enlightened for the benefit of others, we'll recite the four immeasurable thoughts together. So think that may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now, to bring about this enlightenment, we need to abandon what is not useful and adopt everything useful. And this is all summed up in the seven limb prayer. So let's recite this together. So reverently I prostrate with my body, speech and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time. I rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now we come to the short mandala offering, who in the essence of this is to let go. In particular, let go of the conception of true existence and grasping at that. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is a Buddha field and offer it. And may all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kangriyatayami. Now I think that the offering has been accepted with joy, and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas smile at you in delight. You acknowledge that smile and a transformation takes place within you. I think as a result of this transformation, your mind is wide open, soft, spacious and generous. And because the mind is like that, you're able to listen to these teachings, take them on, understand them, and put them into place as soon as you can.
I used the wrong microphone. It's so quiet. You're really quiet. Where was that? The little system mic just went really, really, really quiet.
So what have we covered? We've looked at the three types of compassion. Compassion in the beginning, the middle, and end is the most important of these types. Then bodhicitta itself, radical altruism. We defined it as a mind that wishes to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of others. We looked at impartiality and its types. So impartiality, of course, meaning the practice of equanimity and equalizing self and others. And last week we looked at the seven cause and effect method of the great elder Lama Atisha. We're going to have a look at the other common practice, and this is the practice of equanimity in Shantideva's equalizing self and other method of meditation. So this meditation, equalizing self and others, got five steps within it, but the first step is this equanimity, and it's a slightly different way of generating equanimity than we've discussed in the previous class. I think I'll just leave it there and I'll go on. So these are the readings that I've relied upon to extract information from to present the class. So Geshe Sopa's book and Geshe Loden's book are both commentaries on Lama Tsongkhapa's Lam Rim, and it's within both those books this method, you can find this method in there. Miles Neal's book up the top there, this is presenting the path from the point of view of Lama's Tsongkhapa's three principal aspects of the path. And there's also information in that book too, some very good information on this practice and the equanimity involved in it. All the other books, of course, especially this one down the bottom here called Just Achieving Bodhicitta, once again the method is in there. The book called Buddhism by the Dalai Lama and Thupten Chodron. He's got a very extensive presentation on equanimity, and this type of meditation is also in there. So a number of good books with commentary on the practice. I think I'll leave it there. So let's go on and have a look at this type of equanimity, which is the uncommon equanimity. It really belongs to the the great scope. So it's Mahayana equanimity. And it's got sort of two aspects here. One is from the relative point of view, and that's from the point of view of others and from our own point of view. And then we also have from the deepest point of view. Now, the deepest point of view doesn't mean the point of view from emptiness. It just means a sort of a deeper point of view. Now, the phrase equalizing refers to the practice of reflecting upon the equality of oneself and others, and having the natural and spontaneous wish to enjoy happiness and avoid suffering. Now, the generation of this type of equanimity, was presented often by one of His Holiness the Dalai Lama's tutors, and it's quite, according to His Holiness, is very effective and very powerful. And we see here we've got a relative point of view, we've got from the point of view of others, so there are three points in that. From our own point of view, there are three points, and from the deepest point of view, there are three points. So it's like a 9-round meditation. To summarize in a way, to equalize ourselves and others, we're sort of investigating our innate feelings of self-importance and realizing that there is actually no reason to justify it, because our others and ourselves are equal in wanting happiness and wanting freedom from suffering. So let's go along and have a look at these 9 points. So from the viewpoint of others, from the point of view of others, as it says, you know, you and I are the same. So there's no point in being prejudiced. So insofar as the natural wish to avoid suffering is concerned, you and I are the same. So there's no point in being like partial or prejudiced. So one of the ways that you can do this is to use that meditation of, it would be, how wonderful it would be if I could abandon the feelings of attachment, aversion, and indifference towards others, because then the mind would be free from biased attitudes and I would always have an equally warm and friendly attitude towards everyone else. How wonderful that would be. As for myself, I do not want to suffer even in my dreams. And no matter how much happiness I have, I never feel as if it's enough. And this is the same with absolutely everyone else. So all limited beings, all samsaric beings, from a tiny bug up to a human being, wish to be happy and to never suffer or to have other problems. Therefore, it's not right, it's improper to reject some and to welcome others. So in relation to this point, the Dalai Lama says, develop the thought that all sentient beings are equal insofar as the natural wish to avoid suffering is concerned, and that therefore there is no point in being partial or discriminatory. One of the books I didn't put up there was a book called Path to Bliss. So these 9 points are also in that by the Dalai Lama, and that was also one of the books I relied upon. So this is the first sub point or first point in this view of others. The second one. Because you and I equally desire happiness, there's no need to discriminate between us. So His Holiness says, reflect that all sentient beings equally desire happiness, and therefore there is no ground for discriminating between them when working for their benefit. The situation is analogous to one where you might encounter 10 equally wretched beggars who are desperately asking you to relieve their hunger. So in such circumstances, it is senseless to have any feeling of preference. Alexander Berzin says, for all sentient beings who equally desire happiness, even their ordinary happiness, which is what everyone is desiring, is tainted with confusion. And so, of course, everyone lacks a sufficient supply. Everyone is keenly interested in gaining more happiness. Therefore, it's improper to reject some people and keep them distant, and to welcome others to be close. And the third of these 3 points. We are the same in that we equally lack genuine happiness. And we are the same in that having suffering, we wish to be free of it. So there's a term, genuine happiness, put here. So genuine happiness is really pointing at the happiness of liberation and the happiness of enlightenment. So as sentient beings, we equally lack that type of happiness, really stable, long-lasting, unchanging happiness. But we do experience suffering, and we wish to be free of it. So this meditation is very similar again. So instead of the 10 beggars, we sort of imagine yourself going into a ward with 10 or more people, and they're all suffering from the virus. They're all equal in being miserable and pathetic. It's unfair to favour some and to treat only them and to forget about the others. Likewise, all limited beings, meaning sentient beings, are equally miserable with their specific individual troubles and with the general sufferings of samsara. Because of that, it's unfair and improper to reject some, keeping them distant, and to welcome others and draw them in close. His Holiness from Path to Bliss says, develop an equanimity based on the reflection that all sentient beings are equal in that they lack genuine happiness. Now, although they lack genuine happiness, each of us has the innate desire to possess it. And likewise, all sentient beings are the same in having suffering and wishing to avoid it. So these three points lead to this conclusion, which is in the next slide. So as there's no rational basis at all for me to be biased towards any sentient being, there are no grounds for neglecting the welfare of a single sentient being. And so I shall care as deeply for you as I care for myself. It's I remember when I first sort of come to this conclusion, it's quite shocking, I think, or shocked me at least. So with these types of practice, we're trying to train the mind. I shall never discriminate between beings, always work equally to help them overcome suffering and gain happiness. So is there anything anybody would like to say about this or ask anything about it?
We've got time to put it in the chat, people. Even if you just think about it and jot it in, I can always find a good place to ask Eddie. But so far, there's nothing there, Eddie.
I should just point out to all of you, if you've downloaded the slides, you'll have all the same information on them. You might find them very useful then to sort of, each of these slides is a meditation actually. So if you could just say what's on those slides and then come to this conclusion, therefore I shall care as deeply for you as I care for myself. Of course, we won't be able to implement this immediately, but we can sort of like extend it out a little bit. Like, for instance, I'm sure any of you who are mothers or parents have actually done this towards your children. Probably a bit later on, you might have stopped. But we have been able to do it. You know, it's just that our mind has not been able to do it stably, to be consistent in doing it. We've sort of done it naturally, but then naturally we've dropped it too because of our bias. You know, we find it difficult to be hurt when we're hurt, especially from family members, and so we stop caring as deeply for them as we care for ourselves. So think about it, try and take these things each day perhaps, because if you take them each day and think about them and reflect upon them and make them really familiar to yourself, then over time you'll be able to work through and generate great love, then great compassion, and then finally, of course, the mind of enlightenment. But those three other things, great love, great compassion, the mind of enlightenment, you won't be able to accomplish them unless you actually have equanimity towards others. So this is just like a foundation, but without it, we can't build the rest of the practices. Like I said, now let's look upon the next three, and these are all from our own point of view, my own point of view. This one says, all sentient beings are equally kind to me, and they have all at one time or another been my closest friends and relatives. So remember, I think it was last week or the week before, we looked at the six causes and one effect. And one of them was all sentient beings have been my mother. So this plays into that. So once again, from His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, in the book Path to Bliss, he says, you might have thought that although reflection upon the equality of others is persuasive regarding the futility of your being discriminatory towards other beings, surely when viewed from your own side, the situation will look quite different. After all, some people are friends and help you, whereas many others harm you. To counter this thought, which attempts to give false grounds for being partial towards others, reflect that all sentient beings are equally kind to you. They have all been at one time or another your closest friends and relatives. Hence, there's no rational basis at all for being biased towards any one of them. So, you know, if you've been to teachings by His Holiness, or even a concert by Leonard Cohen, you know, I remember Leonard coming out and saying, brothers and sisters. And His Holiness does the same. You know, he comes down and says, brothers and sisters. So he's acknowledging the relationship, countless relationships that we've had with one another. And he's talking to us as if we are part of his family. And, you know, actually we have been. We've been related to everybody. And so this is what we have to sort of remember. It's very, very easy to forget this if you're sleeping at night and there's a mosquito buzzing around your ear, you know, and you just want to whack it. Or if you come home and you find cockroaches scuttling away, you know, very quickly you grab a can and spray them. And of course, when we do those sorts of things, we're actually trying to kill them. So of course, when we're doing that, we have whatever idea we have of all sentient beings have been mothers and brothers and sisters, it's just an idea, isn't it? Hasn't sort of got down into our blood and bone and think, you know, actually this being that looks like this right now once was a mother to me. Just not in this life, just not right now. So once again, not an easy thing to do. So the second, and from my own point of view, number two, this kindness of sentient beings is not confined to when they are friends and relatives alone. The kindness is when they are enemies is boundless. So this requires us to understand how our greatest growth actually comes about through facing difficulties. So when they were enemies and harmed us in any way at all, if we were patient with that and did not respond unkindly and unskillfully towards them, that would mean that we're not creating any new karma, any new negative karma. So these people become like our teachers to us, showing us where we actually are and what we can do. So by being patient towards others, we're developing our own inner strength. And this can only come about when others are trying to harm us.
Eddie, there's a question. So are cockroaches sentient beings?
Yep. You think they... if you're unsure of that, so one of the things that for a sentient being does, it feels. That a sentient being feels. So they know what causes suffering, right? They are interested in their own welfare. Like all you have to do is put the light on and walk in the room and they run away from you, don't they? You know, there's already fear there. They try to protect themselves by running away. And when you're not there, they come out, of course, and they're searching for food. So they experience hunger. So there are feelings that come along with hunger. They experience fear when we chase them. And I'm sure they're just like us, that they don't want to die, especially when you see them die. You know, they're running around and they fall, their backs and their legs are scratching at the air. Just imagine, you know, like us, if we were suddenly deprived of air, if somebody put a plastic bag over our head and held it there, our limbs would start thrashing about just like the legs of a cockroach do. And so they seek to be free of suffering and harm, and they wish to experience the happiness of cockroaches. So they do feel.
And I'm thinking they could also then, we could experience their kindness by having to really learn to practice patience and prevention and all that kind of thing.
Yes, there is. So I also remember the story, some of you might also have seen the film, of Papillon. So he was put into a cell in a solitary confinement, completely black in there, and the only light that came through during the day was the light that came underneath the door. And what came through that crack was like a cockroach. And then he had somebody to talk to. He had some living being to extend our kindness to. So he was able to, you know, keep little bits of his food, and he'd wait for that cockroach to come, and then he would feed it and talk to it. And it helped him keep his sanity, because he had some other being to extend our love towards, or kindness.
So then, Eddie, there's another question. If someone is physically harming me, I should stay with them because they're teaching me how to respond with kindness?
Well,
probably depends if you have a choice or not.
Sorry?
Depends if you have a choice.
This really depends. It's not you don't have to stay with them. You can choose to stay with them, or you can choose to leave them. It really depends upon how you look at it and what you're trying to accomplish. Because there's answers here you can say, you can give plenty of reasons to say no to this, and you can also give reasons to say yes. It really depends upon what you're trying to accomplish, where you actually are in terms of your spiritual growth. Because if you were to stay there and be hurt and abused and were resentful of that, and you did not strike back or try to stop them doing it through fear, that wouldn't be any type of practice. That's not practice. Yeah, and if that was happening, then you could say, all I'm doing by staying here is this person I'm with is just creating more and more negative karma whenever they hurt me. And me, when I'm hurt, I'm also creating more negative karma for myself in the way I think about it. That thinking is an action. So there's not much good going on there. So you could say, best I leave. But there are other cases you could also put forward to. You could say, well, best I stay. The answer is highly dependent here. Is that useful for that person who asked that question?
I think so. I think it's clear. Yes.
So to sum this one up, this Holiness says, you know, the noble ideals of patience and tolerance, which are traits vital for the generation of great compassion and mind of enlightenment, are only provided by the opportunities of training with a person of ill will. So,
can you just say that again?
Yeah. The noble ideals of patience and tolerance, traits vital for the generation of great compassion and the mind of enlightenment, are only provided by the opportunities of training with a person of ill will, a person who has malice towards you. Now, you'll find that if you're in a relationship with anyone, and both of you being unenlightened, there are times when one partner will exhibit malice towards another or ill will. So I'd suggest there's your opportunity. But so this is not saying that you allow yourself to be just walked over and hurt. That's not what's been, I'm not saying that either. So like being patient here is that, what's the other term they use for patience? Forbearance. To able to bear the slings and arrows that others throw at them. But you're quite entitled to say, excuse me, what are you doing? No, to call them on their behavior. Because if you don't, what that other person is doing is creating a karma for more suffering for them. And that sort of habit of being malicious to one another or having ill will and sort of acting on it, whether it be through speech or physically, is a creator of suffering. So you don't want your partners to make that a habit. So you've got to find skillful ways to pull them up on that, and at the same time yourself, do not create any negative karma by having resentment or ill will yourself when you respond to them. You've got to sort of see it as being, my gosh, my partner and I, we both want to be happy. And yet we're not, and what we do actually creates more suffering for us. I've got to work as hard for myself, as hard as I work for myself, I need to work that hard for the other. So when we're patient for ourselves, then what are we doing for the other person? So, you know, you might have to call them up on it. But basically, you know, this is this, you'll see this over and over, especially if you read biographies of sort of great people. Often many of them were hurt by different people. And you'll find that many of them did not respond in unskillful ways. They had to be patient with it and use it to grow themselves. And they did. And we need to do the same. And like we can. So also you need to be a bit patient with yourself. You won't always be able to do it, but sometimes you will. So when you're not, if you start responding back with malice or ill will, please try and catch yourself and apologize. Say, I'm sorry. So, you know, Miffy and I, we have this thing where we say sometimes, can we start again? Let's just start again. They go, oh, yeah, okay. So we just drop it all and then we start again. Okay, let's have a look at the third one then. So from my own point of view again, so we are all subject to suffering and impermanence. So there's no sense in being selfish and unfair to others when we are all subject to suffering and impermanence. So in the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, written by Shantideva, there's a couple of verses where Shantideva talks about the great power of patience. And he says, there is no sense in someone who is himself subject to suffering and impermanence, being selfish and discriminatory towards others who are also tormented by the same fate. For example, it would be quite senseless and stupid for 10 convicted criminals who are sentenced for execution within a short time by the law to argue amongst themselves and squabble and fight amongst themselves, for their days are numbered. Now, I remember in I've got a film here about prisons in Siberia, and the camera goes into the jails and it goes along and it sort of points into the cells, and every cell is overcrowded. In fact, there's no room for, it's so overcrowded, there's no room for a person to just lie down and sleep. So when the lens is pointed through the bars, what you see in there is a whole lot of men all standing together, really quiet. And what they do is then they take turns sleeping. So they understand, you know, that all of them are subject to this overcrowding and suffering. So it makes no sense at all to squabble amongst each other and to, you know, fight and probably kill one another. So they, knowing that, they are patient. You know, knowing that they're all equal, all subject to suffering and impermanence. So in conclusion, because I cannot distinguish between our desires being forced for happiness and to avoid suffering. So I choose to never be intolerant of your happiness, and I choose to always help you overcome your suffering as I do my own. It's very rational, isn't it? It's very sensible. We don't do that. We, you know, being irrational beings, we sort of get upset pretty quickly. But this, I think this conclusion is a wonderful conclusion to come to, and I can see how so many relationships would be so much happier if both people could take something like this and integrate it into their lives. So this is the second conclusion. We've looked from the point of view of others, and or from others' point of view, and we've looked from our own point of view. Once again, does anybody have any questions you'd like to ask?
No questions yet.
Okay. So once again, I do encourage you to have a look at these slides again and just sort of contemplate this, you know, contemplate if we are the same, you know, and I want happiness, then it's not rational to be intolerant toward you who also wish to be happy. And so, just because I want to avoid suffering and I do everything I can to avoid it, you wish to avoid suffering too. I should help you do the same.
So this, the way that it's phrased, never be intolerant of your happiness, what, yeah. Can you kind of develop on that for a moment?
Well, I'm sure most people would have been in situations where people have been happy around them and then somebody doesn't like it. That's what we mean by intolerant of your happiness. You know, for instance, sometimes there are people that want to come to the Dharma Center and do our classes. Right? And that is a means for them to be happy. But you'll find that either the husband or the wife that's left at home doesn't like it. This is not an uncommon thing to happen, right? So they become intolerant of the other person's search for happiness and their engagement in a means to be happy. So that's just an example of, I think, of a, you know, ordinary type of intolerance.
Is there also, so that question was from Deepa. I'm just also wondering, is there, is this to guard against jealousy of others' happiness?
Yeah, well, that's jealousy is, well, you know, that's what comes up, isn't it? You don't like the other person to be happy without you or doing something on your own. So either it's jealous or maliciousness. You know, it's those of you who are married or in relationships, sometimes when you have to, you know, to go to the center, you leave your partner at home and, you know, before you leave, they, you know, they're not happy that you're going. You know, it's so much desirous attachment involved in that, you know, and this is a huge difference, isn't it? Being, they're just attached to their own happiness. But and so there's an intolerance towards you seeking your own, of being happy, doing something on your own. And so there might be jealousy, it could be fear, you know, all the stuff in, attachment-based. Attachment coming out of, you know, this great grasp of itself, what we call the self-cherishing. You know, my happiness is more important than yours. If you really loved me or cared for me, you'd stay home. That sort of emotional blackmail that, you know, you can, people should be familiar with.
So then, Eddie, the next question from Sue is then, so what do you do about this sort of person? I mean, because it's kind of ironic, isn't it? Because
yeah,
the whole point of coming to a Dharma center is to be able to, you know, share happiness with everybody. So
yeah, so then you'll you need to talk to that person, and you, before you do, of course, you have to sort of check yourself and see if you're skilled enough to be able to talk to them. So of course you could give it a go and see what happens, and that way you'll find is what you're saying acceptable to them, or are they digging their heels even more and getting more upset and so forth. So then it's that sort of thing, go, you might go, well, look, I'm not skilled enough to do this, to talk to you, you just get upset. Let's go along and see a marriage counsellor. We need to find somebody who's neutral in the middle and will listen to both of our concerns. You know? Because many people have this black and white thinking. You know, so it's like, if you leave me and go there, to me, it means you don't love me. You know, you don't care enough about me. Right? But they don't get the idea. It doesn't happen. They go, oh, you're going away to learn how to be happier. And when you come back home, your happiness will affect me and I'll be happier too. I don't see it. You know, I don't see the bigger picture. It's all, the view is narrowed down to just themselves. So, if you could explain that to somebody, you know, to your nearest and dearest, without them getting upset and storming off and so forth, well, go for it. But if you can't, you'll need to say, you know, like say to them, look, I'm going along to the center to try and find means to be happy because I love you. I want to bring my happiness home and increase the happiness of you and I. That's why I'm going. Please don't stop me doing that. And if, of course, many people still will not stop there. So that's the time you go, there's something not quite right here. We need to get some professional help in here. And Sue, you know, and sometimes, Sue, you have to walk away from them. That's you know, that's there. That's what happens. So in regards to the question, Sue, you've got to try and talk to the other person in a way that shows them that what you're doing is going to be beneficial for them. It's not taking anything away from them other than your time. But your time is going to be well spent. And if that can't be done, then try and get somebody else to come in and help you explain it. And if they still don't do it, then you know you can still go, I'm very sorry that you're unhappy about it, nevertheless I'm going. when I come back, is there anything I can bring you back, you know? Or you bring back something that you know they like, but don't bring back a six pack. So won't make don't bring back alcohol. So is that useful?
Well, there isn't any more questions.
So. Okay. So let's move on then. Let's move to the next.
Sue says yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So now we're going to look at the from the deepest point of view. And this is this next slide, Sue, I guess is pertinent to your question. So Arya Shanti Davis says, whatever joy there is in the world arises from wishing for others' happiness. Whatever suffering there is in the world arises from wishing for your own happiness. Now, this is not obvious. The way we approach life is the wish for our own happiness and do everything we can for our own. And even when we get into relationships, it's about us. You know, we think the other person is going to contribute to my happiness. Most times, not all the time, but most times. And this is the way a natural way is. So everything we're sort of doing actually contributes more and more to suffering. And, you know, you see this, you know, it's quite prevalent in the world that there are not all that many people wishing and working for others' happiness. You know, altruistically. So these next three slides, next three rounds, this is all a meditation, right? Based on insight into the ultimate nature of things and events. But the ultimate does not refer or should not refer to the ultimate truth in terms of emptiness. Rather, it means that the outlook adopted in these visualizations or contemplations is deeper and hence relatively ultimate in comparison to the earlier meditations. So let's have a look now at the deepest point of view. So the first thing to recollect is there are no true enemies. This is the view we have to adopt. But before we can take that view authentically and honestly and naturally, the question to ask first is, are there any true enemies in the real sense of the world, the word? Are there any true enemies? Now, what is meant by true enemies here is an enemy forever, can never change, will always remain an enemy. Are there people that exist like that? So you have to sort of ask this question of you and of yourself and then try and find beings who are true enemies, meaning that they can only harm you. No, they cannot bring you any insights into the nature of reality, that you cannot develop any good qualities in the depends on them, because they are true enemies. They always harm. Now, it's said that the Buddhas themselves have seen and said there are no true enemies. So this enlightened being sees that. We have to sort of say, can we see that? And I suggest we can. I remember when I was locked up, and this was my question, is I was looking for something that would always be true. My question was like, can we find like true evil? Is there something like really that always remains truly evil? I think it always bring harm. And I couldn't find anything like that. So when I come to this type of question, you know, there are no true enemies. I can go, that's right. The way to know that, though, is to try and look for a true enemy. And when you cannot find them, then you can honestly and authentically say, no, there aren't any. The problem for us is, though, that when people do harm us, that we, you know, they're called enemies, harm doers. They seem to be harm doers from their own side. It's like we see them. As soon as we see them, we think that person will harm me because they are harmers. You know, what we've done actually is squeeze their behavior and the person together. So what's that term called, Miffy, when you do that?
Conflate.
Yeah, you conflate when you, a person is not their behavior and behavior is not the person. Yet when we see the person and we've seen their behavior, we're pushed together in our mind. We conflate them and think bad person or enemy, harm doer. So before I go, is there anything anybody would like to ask about this? Can you see that this is how it works, that there are no true enemies?
I'm just wondering, Eddie, there is like the intellectual investigation and understanding, but often stuff that you carry as a child, you have a feeling that someone is a true enemy.
Yeah. So then what the other thing is to do then, that's the person you need to, excuse me, that's the person you need to bring up then and go, this person is the true enemy. This is the person who hurt me. Whenever I see them or think of them, I have fear. Okay, that's what I think. But is it true? Because if they are a true enemy, they need to be true enemies to everyone. Anyone who sees them, that's an enemy. So do you remember that story, Miffy, you told in a class about a man who murdered his children, and a woman was listening to it, and she thought people like that need to be shot and killed. People who kill children like that need to be shot and killed. And then it turned out that the man who did it was her son.
Yeah, that's right. She,
and then she dropped the view completely, didn't she? She said, no, it couldn't be my son.
Because my son isn't evil. And
my son is not evil.
So it couldn't be him. And then it was him. And so then she blamed the woman for making him do that.
That's right. Right, so yeah, the Buddhists say we can't find any true enemies. What we do find is disturbing emotions. I can acknowledge those. Disturbing emotions exist, but there are no enemies or bad people from their own side.
So Jen Compton said, so the true enemy would be the self-cherishing mind.
Yeah, that's right. That's the actual true enemy. Yep. This is a really good thing to contemplate, you know. It'll help you hesitate when you see the bad behaviors of Trump and Boris in England and so many other people who harm people. So, like I said, once again, we often equate the behavior with the person and we get really upset with the person. So, you know, in that way, you know, the person is like an enemy to us or an enemy towards civilization or the people and so forth. But they're not truly enemies. They're not they're not always this way. And what they're doing is really behavior. And the behavior, as Jenna said, has come out of deep self-cherishing. So when we know that there are no true enemies, we can look at the next slide. It says that enemies are not permanent, and so enemies cannot remain the same.
You're such a stirrer, Eddie.
Well, these are so obvious, aren't they? You know?
Especially the double meaning of, because they have such an on-again, off-again relationship.
Yeah, that's right. You know, like, they're friends there, and later on they'll be enemies again. Just highly dependent on behaviour and self-cherishing. Yeah. So this reminds me of the example that, what's her name? One of our students brought up once. So she talked about, you know, one time, I think it was Shariputra, went past the village. And when he went past the village, he saw that a woman was eating fish with her husband while rocking a child on her lap. Then a dog came to snatch the fish off the table, and one of them, you know, grabbed a stone and threw it at the dog. And Shariputra was walking by, could see that one time, the family's worst enemy was the newly born child. And the family dog had once been the mother of the son. And so there was this a change of role over time, you know. And this is what happens with enemies, don't they? The roles, they're constantly changing. They never stay permanent. So another example I'll give you, I remember, so my best friend, he was going out with a girl, and then I came over to visit them, and she was such a piece of work towards them. So as soon as I saw it, I just said, man, I don't like this girl. So whenever we met, I mean, about 15, 16 years went by, and I always knew that. I've seen how this girl behaves. This is how she is. You can't trust this girl, and she's malicious. And then one day my mate said to me, why don't you argue with my wife? And I said, I can't, because I might get upset with her. And he said, what do you mean? He said, well, yeah, you know, I said, you know, about 15, 16 years ago, I came over, you had the broken leg, and she wouldn't bring the meal from the stove over towards him and give it to him, put it in his lap so he could eat. So he had to, like, get up, hobble up with this broken leg, go up there, get the plate, come back down. And she wouldn't help him at all, you know. So I said, you know, I remember what she did. I saw that. So John went and told his wife that, told him. And then one day we were alone together, and she said, oh, you remember that day when we were at home and John had the broken leg and I wouldn't serve him dinner and all this stuff? You know, I had a really bad day that day. And as soon as she told me, I just thought, oh, of course, people can have bad days. You know, it doesn't mean what I thought it meant. So because of her behavior, I labeled, you know, bitch on her. You know, I put a label on her. That's who you are, and you're untrustworthy. You're like mean, but you're my best mate's girlfriend. So, you know, that's done. But I don't trust you, and I know you're a mean piece of work. Until she said that, you know. No, I had this really bad day. And then I knew that she was a really good mother to the children they had adopted. And she was really ethical and all these other things. But all of that was shut down because I could only focus on that behavior and equate her with the behavior. So in a way, she was like, you know, looks like it's an enemy, but I could never get close to her. I would never allow myself to be close to her, or reveal anything about myself to her, like, for instance, through an argument. So I was sort of standoffish and sort of indifferent towards her. And this was only because I'd seen this behavior and I'd labeled it and thought, that's who you are, and you that's it. You know, you won't change. You are that person. Your behavior, and you, that's you. And so I took in my mind she was permanently that way. Yet when she told me that she'd had this bad day, I just went, oh my God, you know, I had to drop that whole view and going, yeah, behaviors aren't permanent. People aren't permanent. There's only a few things that are permanent, and behaviors and people aren't. So when people behave unskillfully and hurt others and so forth, and we dislike that and equate them with their behavior, we have to bring back what in the previous slides, you know, man, this person just wants to be happy. This person just wants to avoid suffering. But everything that they do to avoid suffering just brings about more suffering. They don't actually know how to be authentically happy. And we're all in that boat. You're just the same as me. You know, I've done things that are really unskillful and hurt people. And I'm sure they can look back at me whenever they see me, they've got their idea about who I am. And we do this to others. But this is not true.
So Jen says, thanks for sharing that, Eddie. We're all biased, even though we wish we weren't.
Yeah, this is right. And like, especially now, isn't it? You know, when we have some sort of insight into the truth, then we do wish we weren't biased. But you'll meet other people, Jen, who will not accept that they're biased. They just think, no, this is the way it is. I'm telling you the truth. You know, I'm telling you it's like this way. And when we try and show another way, if we're not all that skillful in it, they choose to not like us too. Let's have a look now at the next one, the third one. So the concepts or ideas or names of friend, enemy and stranger exist in mere name and are mutually dependent. So if we look for an example of mutually dependent, so I'll go back a bit. So a mere name means that if you look for the person who has done the behavior, if you look at the person from the side of what's appearing to you, which would be their body, right? You don't find a person there. You know that the person is more than a body, they've also got a mind. So if you look for the person within the mind, or the owner of them, of the body and mind, separate from them, they're just not there. You don't actually find these terms, friend, enemy, and stranger, when you search amongst the basis for that name. Yet friend, enemy, and stranger exist. How? Like in name, in mere name. And it's dependent, particularly mutually dependent. So friend exists independence upon our enemy. Enemy exists independence upon stranger. Stranger exists independence upon person you know. Person you know exists independence upon stranger, and they're mutually dependent, like close and far. So here we have this, it's not so much emptiness here, it's really a dependent arising or mutual dependence. So concepts of friend, enemy and stranger are relative and exist only at the conventional level. They are mutually dependent, as are the concepts of long and short, near and far, here and there, you and I. A person may be an enemy in relation to one person, while at the same time being a dear friend to another and a stranger to another. It is our misapprehension of friends, relatives and enemies as inherently existent that gives rise to the fluctuating emotions that we have towards them. Therefore, by realizing that there is no inherently existent friend, enemy, or stranger, we can overcome our biased attitudes and feelings towards them. So I put this picture up here. So I remember Miffy wondering, like, why is this picture here? She wanted to put a different picture. I said, no, we've got to put this picture up. And the reason for that is because we have two mountain peaks. And if you were standing on one, then this would be the near mountain peak and the other would be the far mountain peak. But if you went to stand on the other side, what you're calling far, now it would be the near. And what was once near would now be far. So near and far are dependent upon the designation you give to them, meaning the name near and far, and that's dependent upon where you are in relationship to them. But there's no near and far mountain there on its own. And this is just the same as the idea of friend, enemy, and strangers exist conventionally in mere name, dependent upon one's relationship to them. When we look at the relationship, most of us are just looking through the lens of one life, and also the lens of inherent existence. So we need to sort of stop grasping at these terms to be truly existent and broaden the view to be greater than one life. And then we can see that friends were once enemies and strangers, and enemies were once friends and strangers, and strangers were once enemies and friends. And if we look for the label, the person we call friend, within the friend itself, we don't find any friend there. Yet, these terms all exist conventionally. So friends and enemies are just different ways of looking at or regarding a person. Someone can be both one person's friend and another person's enemy. So I remember that term many years ago. There was to establish the state of Israel, the Jews formed an organization, and one of the things they did was they bombed this hotel. It killed heaps of people. It killed heaps of English soldiers, and the English called these Jewish fighters terrorists. Yet the Jews themselves call themselves freedom fighters. Now, if you look, the same situation is going on today. Now it's just not against the English, it's against the Arabs and the Palestinians. And both sides will call the other the enemy. And both sides will call the other the terrorist. And both sides will call themselves freedom fighters. So this is like the mountains, near and far, far and near. The objects exist, but not inherently, not truly, just dependent upon name and their mutual dependence. So would anybody like to say anything about this?
Eddie, I was just thinking with that example that the great leveller that I found really nice between the Palestine and Israel was the orchestra that they got together of young people's orchestra of teenagers from either side. So you change the context and now suddenly everybody's friends.
Friends. That's right. That's right. And you change the context and the labels change. Yeah. And, you know, I've seen this too in other places, haven't they? Where they've introduced sporting events. And they take, you know, the two sides and they mix both sides half-half. And then so one side might be, you know, five Israelis and five Palestinians, the other side the same. And then they have a game. And so they need to depend upon each other to play as a team that, you know, gets the highest score.
So Ben has said, one cannot know what a friend is without knowing what an enemy is. The meaning of each is mutually dependent.
That's right. That's right. If there's all friends, I mean, if everybody's a friend, then there aren't any enemies, then the whole term is sort of meaningless, isn't it? Because the term, you know, like, it's like, what's opposite to friend? He's like, there isn't any opposite. We're all the same.
So then my question would be then, how do you come to a conclusion then that isn't just flatlining and going nihilistic of, but actually, you know, has that equal, you know, care and concern?
Okay, so to be nihilistic here or would be, there are no friends, there are no strangers, there are no enemies. That's just not true. You could just laugh at them in their face and go, you must be joking, mate. Or you have to laugh at yourself. I believe that. It's like, hang on a minute. There's lots of people I don't know. They're strangers to me.
And Sue's just said, but I thought you said there were no enemies.
If there are no friends, Sue, then there are no enemies. There are no enemies, there are no friends. They're dependent. It's just like that sort of thing of you and I. You know, if you look for the sense of you or you and I are highly dependent. There's no true you, there's no true I. You and I exist in mere name. So it's good that you brought that up, Nifi, about the nihilism thing, because that's what we often do. We go to the two extremes. You know, then there are no friends, enemies, and strangers. And you go, there are no truly existent friend, enemies, and stranger. But friends, enemies, and strangers exist in, you know, mere name, and are mutually dependent, and are dependent upon many other phenomena too, like a relationship.
And then Jen Compton has added in, and what about frenemies?
Well, they exist too, don't they? So, in conclusion, as I have no justification at all to hold grudges against persons that call me harm, I have to overcome any biased feelings I have towards them. And ignoring disinterest in their welfare, decide to never neglect them. So this is not an easy thing to do either, but there is an easy place to start. His Holiness has often recommended this, and that is to smile at people you don't know. Start with a smile. And others will say, hello. So, yeah. Remember that story, I think, if he was, I think it was Lama Yeshe, when he was in the trains in India. So he'd always go and sit with people he had no idea who they were, different people, and start taking interest in them. And you go, of course, that's the bodhisattva way, isn't it? Don't neglect anybody.
Yeah, and Geshe Zopa does that as well.
Yeah, that's right. There's, you know, they've got this remarkable openness and ease about themselves. They just, yeah, make themselves available to others.
Yeah, and Geshe Zopa, because I came across him in, I must have been in Tasmania, and I just saw him across the mall, and he didn't know I was there, and I was just watching him, and he managed to look completely ordinary and just strike up ordinary conversations with people.
Yeah, okay, fantastic, yep.
Okay. Also, Eddie, Ben said a great analogy of inherent existence that he read the other day is that it would be that you could have upper floors without there being lower floors in a building, because floors would not be dependent on the lower floors.
That's right. That's a good one, Ben. It's you won't forget that, will you? That's right. Okay. So, to continue. So, therefore, the Mighty One, the Buddha, has said that the field of sentient beings is similar to a Buddha field. For many who have pleased them have thereby reached perfection. In other words, if we lose the bias that we have, the bias of attachment, aversion, and indifference to the people we call friends, enemies, and strangers, losing that bias gives us a levels playing field to develop love, compassion, and the mind of enlightenment. And in that way, we can reach enlightenment ourselves. So these are five decisions we can make to help us develop impartiality and move on further to the mind of enlightenment. So the first thing is, you know, I shall stop being partisan, meaning biased. We need to think that others and oneself are no different. No one wishes even the slightest suffering, nor is ever content with any happiness they possess. Second, I have to get rid of self-cherishing. So along with each of these, there are verses that are in the Lama Chöpa. So he's in this one, it says, inspire me to see that this chronic disease of self-cherishing is the cause giving rise to my unsought suffering, and thus begrudging it as what is to blame, and to destroy this monstrous demon of selfishness. I shall make cherishing others my main practice. Inspire me to see that the mind that cherishes my mothers and would secure them in bliss is the gateway leading to infinite virtues. And thus to cherish these wandering beings more than my life, even should they loom up as enemies. And then I can exchange my attitudes regarding self and others, and we can, many others have done so. So in brief, inspire me to develop the mind that understands the distinctions between the faults of infantile beings slaving for their own selfish ends and the virtues of the Buddha working solely for the sake of others, and thus to be able to equalize and exchange my attitude concerning myself and others. Now today we've just been looking at the practice of equalizing. Next week we look at the exchange. Then I shall exchange my attitudes regarding self and others. And since cherishing myself is the doorway to all torment, while cherishing my mothers is the foundation for everything good, inspire me to make my core practice the yoga of exchanging others for myself. So others and myself really mean self-concern and other concern. We need to swap self-concern, the self-concern we have for ourselves, to be concerned for other. Arya Shantideva from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life says, what need is there to say much more? The childish work for their own benefit, while Buddhas work for the benefit of others. Just look at the difference between them. Actually, in the commentary it says, there's no need for lengthy commentary here. Ordinary beings think only of themselves. Without resting day or night, they work exclusively in their own interest. The only result they'll reap from this is suffering both now and in the hereafter. Whereas if you could just make that exchange and work for others, then your happiness is also assured, and even Buddhahood could eventuate. So this brings us to our summary. So in brief, there are no grounds for neglecting the welfare of others, and we should care as deeply for them as we care for ourselves. That we will not be intolerant of the happiness of others and always help others overcome their suffering. And there's no justification at all for us to hold grudges against those who cause harm and to then neglect the welfare of them. So those are the major summaries are these. We've got these nine reasons, we've got three conclusions. And in those nine reasons, the first six points of view was one, three were from the point of view of others, three were from ourselves, and the last were from the deepest point of view. And the equalizing here is the, we're trying to get the feeling that there is no difference at all between ourselves and others. So again, we want to have a feeling that there is no difference between ourselves and others. So have a look. This is the have a look at this material here. We've got pages 74 and 76, pages 9 to 12, and there's a meditation on the nine reason equanimity on page 13. So this is you've been able to download all these notes. Let's have a look through this. All the reasons, of course, you already have them on the your handout. These little slides. So they're all there as well, but they're also written again. So we're about to finish up. Is there anything anybody else would like to add before I dedicate our practice, which I forgot to do last week? I got so excited to see you all. I forgot, not tonight.
sorry, Eddie, Jane was just asking, so those verses, so they're in Guru Puja.
That's right, yep.
Yeah. Is there a particular author? I can't remember.
Panchen Yishi Gelson, I think it is. The Panchen Lama. So, Biffy, now what? Shall I do the dedication?
Yeah, so just stop the screen share. And then
is that on the new share one?
No, down the bottom. Okay. It'll be red and it'll just say stop share.
So I see it. Yep, yep, stop share.
Okay. So now you can do a dedication.
Okay. So due to the past, present and future merits, which are like a dream and exist in mere name, which have been created by myself, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and sentient beings, who are also like a dream and exist in mere name. May each one of us attain enlightenment, which is like a dream and exists in mere name. And by doing so, lead all dream-like sentient beings who exist in mere name to that enlightenment, which is like a dream existing in mere name. By oneself alone, which does not exist from the side of the body and mind, but does exist in name only. By doing so, may we repay the kindness of our teachers and the lineage of teachers and our parents and all sentient beings. So thank you, everybody, for joining us in the discovery of the mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, and sort of understanding a little bit about the practice of exchanging, equalizing, exchanging self with us. So that's it. Hello, Meta. I can see you, gorgeous. Ben, is that your partner there, Ben? Yep. Hello. Pauline, lovely to see you.
Betsy says hello to everybody.
Oh, is Patricia? Hey, Patsy. Hey. Ian, good to see you, mate. Deborah, Anne, very dark there, Anne. Sue, hello. Mandy, nice to see you. And Deb, great to see you all. Fantastic.